Shalom, good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet 104.6 FM. Shalom, Carvin.
Shalom, John.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
And so we're going to do stage two of your project, which I think is the first that we've ever done in quite this...
We've never really spent that much time talking about me, and
so I'm
all verklempt. I think we've only ever done one or two parters where we've talked about a subject over two different Sundays. So
I think we have done that in the history of music.
And
one of the things that I've noticed in part one that we played, you haven't played a oud or any one of those.
No, but what I have played is the theremin. And so let me talk a little bit about the theremin. It's one of my favorite instruments.
It was
the first fully electronic instrument. It was invented by a man in Russia named Leon Theremin, but his name was changed to Leon. His name was Lev Theremin.
And I get the picture.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you you draw the connection there. And he was a scientist, and he was charged by the Soviet government. He worked for the technology division of the KGB, and they required him. Lenin himself demanded that he invent a radio mind control device.
What?
Now this is in 1919. He was commanded to invent a radio mind control device.
What's that?
Exactly. What is that? And so he knew that if he didn't show something by his deadline, he would be in trouble. But he also knew that by moving his hands through a radio field, he could change the pitch of one of his oscillators that he'd been playing with. So he turned it into an instrument and learned to play Bach's Air on a G-String on this instrument. And it was fully electronic, and you play it without touching it. It's one of those really odd quirks of early Soviet technology. And so when he was called upon to introduce his radio mind control device to Lenin, he said, "It is well known that music can control the minds of thousands of people. This may seem like a small thing to you, but it is the birth of something entirely new." And then he played his bit of Bach on his new instrument, which sounded so strange and unusual. And immediately, Lenin, who was known for being a very, very hard man, burst out laughing and commissioned to have one built for every room in the Kremlin. So at one point in the Kremlin, there were one of these electronic instruments in every room.
Well, what was the purpose?
The purpose was, the purpose was to just have a musical instrument as far as theremin was concerned. And he became obsessed with his own instrument. He was sent away on goodwill tour concerts where orchestral works were adapted to play his instrument, the theremin. And in doing so, the fame of the new Soviet Union at the time would be spread far and wide. Now, it's a whole other rabbit hole to go down about the history of Lev Theremin, and sometime I'll have to come back and talk about him because at one point he was in New York performing. Performing a concert, and he defected. And he lived in the U.S. for about 20 years. And then he was kidnapped back to Russia and spent some years in the gulag for having defected. Uh-huh. And then they just put him right back to work again, building electronic things. So this instrument that I'm going on about was also the one that was famously used in Bernard Herrmann's score for The Day the Earth Stood Still. So it sounds very sci-fi.
Okay, let's get back to the story.
Okay, so back to the story. I use this instrument in there to give the sense of ghostliness and the supernatural. When I was putting together my orchestration, I actually looked to how Tchaikovsky would have put things together. So there's a pair of bassoons, there's a pair of oboes, there's a pair of flutes, there's a piccolo, and to have have this kind of very classical orchestra going on, and that's what we listen to in the making of this thing.
So this is you in the footsteps of the masters.
Well, that was the only way to go, because otherwise I'd be blazing new trails, and I was already doing something that I had no idea what to do about. For example, I'd never built puppets before.
How to make a puppet?
I had no idea what I was doing. This entire film, I told you that a friend last week, I told you that a friend of mine who worked for Disney sat me down and taught me how to animate and taught me, you know, that you move if I'm going to stop motion animate, that I would move a puppet this far and take a picture, move it again, and until I had enough pictures that made it look like it was moving. But what I didn't say last week was that I had no idea how to build puppets, so I read up on this thing that all of the stop motion puppets had an inner wire structure or metal structure called an armature, and so I ran into some guy who made wire sculptures, and I said, "Can you make me some miniature skeletons that I can build puppets around?" And out of wire.
You just happened to bump into these people.
This is the story of my life. I'm always running into people. Someday I'll tell you a story about how I accidentally ran into Steven Spielberg. I accidentally knocked him over. I'm sorry, Steven. I really didn't mean it. But all my life, I've always just run into people and had just enough sense to stop and talk to them. So I ran into this guy who made me some wire skeletons, and so I built these puppets and made miniature little costumes and put them and dressed them and made them do things. And
so you got a sewing machine.
I did at the time when I was living in Hollywood, but I didn't bring it with me because the power wasn't the same as the power here. So all the original things I built, otherwise I actually stitched things together by hand. And again, I had no idea what I was doing. I just started doing it. And so I built the interior of an entire carnival funhouse, different rooms. There's several circus rooms that are wired with lights, like you know, big chase lights and marquee lights, like you'd see at a carnival.
In
miniature. And so I used fairy lights and Christmas lights and things that you'd find at a hardware store and pushed through bits of cardboard. And using liter upon liter of acrylic paint. I mean, the whole thing is nuts. And then after years of doing this and of building it and shooting it, and at one point I lost my studio and the whole thing moved to my kitchen table at home. And then finally, after all of this insanity, I ended up with this film. And what the heck do I do with this?
I think that you have been possessed.
I think so.
By some weird out something or other.
it's a Dybbuk.
One thing you didn't include was the Dybbuk.
This time.
Okay, next time.
At some point, I may have to include one that has Dybbuks and golems. So my first goal was to try to get into the New Zealand International Film Festival, and it didn't get in. And I tried to get it into...
How dare they?
And I know. Come on, guys. and tried to get it into Show Me Shorts. Now, all this time, this has been a New Zealand film. Okay, don't get me wrong. I come up with the idea when I was living in Hollywood, but 99% of the work of actually doing this has been here. The whole orchestra are New Zealand players, play people who live here, New Zealand resident players, and you know, even though they come from all over the world to be here, they are players who live here. The all the materials after I moved here were purchased and assembled and done in New Zealand. This has been a New Zealand film, and so when I put this forward into film festivals, when I have to state the nationality of the film, the origin of the film, it's a New Zealand film. There's no question about it. There's, you know, it's not even partially half and half or something. I have to put down it's a New Zealand film.
And it's Deb's influence.
Oh yes. Well, if it hadn't been for her, I wouldn't be here. So yes, absolutely. Also, I had to give her credit on the film as the bat wrangler. Because there are bats that fly through the different sets, and they're and the process of animating bats is I have actually a series of 24 bats that
I saw them swooping.
Yeah, and so I have these 24 different wing positions, and so each different shot is actually a different plastic bat, And so while I was manning the camera, I would say, okay, put up the next bat. And so she would actually place them in the air. They're on a wire. You can't see the wire in the animation, but she placed them on a wire hanging from a track. And so her credit was Bat Wrangler. So she is actually memorialized in this film as well.
Nothing about being Betty.
The whole thing is quite Betty. It's the start to finish. So I actually, when I was very young, I lived and went to high school in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's the very kind of the middle of the United States. And if you've been paying attention to the news, it's also become quite the most backward part of the United States lately. And so I submitted to a film festival in Tulsa, and it was the Tulsa American Film Festival. And they rejected me because my film isn't American. And I explained, you know, I grew up part of my time in Tulsa. I went to high school there and before I moved back to Los Angeles and on to New Zealand. And I was born American. And they said, nope, your film isn't American enough. But the Funhouse as a concept was American originally. And there's a lot of the American Jewish experience kind of embedded in that. Nope, it's not American enough. But they told me, if you would just change... for the purposes of submission, change the nationality of your film and the origin of your film to America. We'll play it. We'll be happy to project your film. And I gave them a properly Kiwi profanity, which they didn't completely understand, that involves what you might do to a turkey on Christmas if you were those who celebrate Christmas. I think you get the picture, and they didn't quite understand it. But my film will not be playing in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because I'm just not American enough. It's a Kiwi film, and it was made with the help of Kiwis, and it was made by Kiwis, and I hope that Kiwis can enjoy it for the creepy, weird absurdity that it is.
What happened when you actually finished it?
Well, when I finished it, then I immediately tried getting it into the different film festivals. I have so far, as of today, submitted it to over 70 film festivals around the world. And because it is quirky and weird, and most people think of animation as something for children, and this has been rated mature by the New Zealand Censors Board because it's not really for children. It's creepy.
But kids love creepy stuff.
Well, that's what I think. I think that kids will actually love it, but it has been rated mature. So now I'm required to tell you that it has been rated. So kids, if you're under 16, you really shouldn't watch it. It's too scary for you. So I've submitted it to all of these film festivals, and it is played in a lot of Eastern Seaboard American film festivals. It is played in the Turin Optical Film Festival, and there it actually won Best Animation and Best Original Score. So I was pleased that my...
Which is with the Italians.
The Italians loved this thing. The thing that pleases me the most is, so I had to submit through the Toronto Animation Days Festival, but Toronto Animation Days part of their job is to assemble the Animation Day at the Cannes Festival. And so the Toronto Festival are in charge of presenting the animation portion of the Cannes Festival in France. And so mine was selected, and it was selected to play before Yellow Submarine at the second largest movie palace at the festival. And I know I mentioned that last week, but it makes me very proud that actually this little film made on no budget with a bunch of Kiwi musicians and
a lot of your imagination
and a lot of my imagination and a crazy amount of time ended up playing in Cannes. And so the idea has been to put it out there and get it throughout the film festival. Ultimately, I would like to get it distributed by one of the online streaming services in Netflix, because in my mind, it's the sort of thing that for the month of October, for all of those people who celebrate Halloween, then it will get lots of plays and people will enjoy it for a month out of every year and then ignore it the rest of the time. And I'm fine with that. I think just being part of this bigger celebration, because, you know, as Danny Elfman once said to me, that Halloween is it's treated by Jews as a strictly Christian festival, but you have to bear in mind the idea it was actually kind of Christianity turned on its head. It's about ghosts and monsters and demons and that kind of thing, and that because it's about Christianity turned on its head, it's actually perfect for Jews to join in and participate in. And I know that there are the religious among us who will object to that. But history is full of Halloween Jews, the most famous being William Henry Pratt, though you probably know him by his other name, Boris Karloff. Carl Laemmle, the founder of Universal Pictures, he was personally involved in the Dracula films and the Frankenstein films, and people always called him a Halloween Jew as though it was an insult. And he was very proud that people called him the Halloween Jew, because he was actually a lot more religious than I am. I'm fairly secular, if you hadn't noticed. And
I
thought you might have. Look, I love my religion. I'm secular because I'm lazy. Let's be honest here.
That's all right. I'll meet you at Pesach.
That's right. And that is still the strongest for me, if I may divert for a minute, the strongest for me of the holidays is Pesach, because we must all remember to be free. But Halloween Jews, Bernard Herrmann, Arnold Schoenberg, Sam Raimi, Jamie Lee Curtis, it's a strong tradition within our people. And Halloween is the moment where among everyone, it's okay to thumb your nose at religion in general.
Well, don't forget the Dybbuk.
Oh, yes. Yes. I think that that we have our own frightening things in our history. We have our own ghosts and spirits and things that are scary. I love the story of the golem, because in the story of the golem, there is a great chunk of truth. I mean, if you look at it as a metaphor, as a lot of these ghost stories are, then it is made from the earth. It is made from the people. And as long as the truth is on the golem's lips, the golem has life and is powerful. And I think that you know, even that little kernel of truth that is hidden in one of our best horror stories, it is important. And I think that part of what Jews bring to the horror genre of storytelling is to embed the truths and the history of our people in a way that everyone can watch them and never even notice that what they're watching is a Jewish story.
Well, I must admit I'm not into horrors and so on. I like happy endings.
Well, then let's make a happy ending out of this.
Tell me what happened next.
Well, what happened next has been a series of awards and a bit of acclaim, and it is my hope that this whole thing becomes a happy ending. I think that for me, there was a sense of excitement in being able to work with world-class musicians and have them perform on my score, because I think, you know, it all began with the music, and at the end of production, it all ended with the music.
Has this been publicized at all as a Kiwi production that has got awards and so on? I haven't read about it.
Only I have publicized it. I think that, you know, very often I have a great talent for being ignored in the artistic world. And so it's been a slow start. We'll just put it that way. I don't like wallowing in the "oh woe is me," because that's just not my style. But it has been a slow start. But the whole reason I did this thing was because I believed in it, and I still believe that it's going to take off. That people are going to see it. It is quirky. It's weird. It's out there, and it's a lot of fun. There are moments that will make you laugh, and there is it is a horror film, so right in the very middle, the 10 minutes into it, there is a moment of absolute horror when you feel a little bit sad and a little bit horrified that such a thing could happen, and then you're kind of swept along into the humor of it, and you're swept along into the silliness of it, because what you're watching is a bunch of puppets tell a story. And for me, I get a little bit of a laugh out of the fact that I was able to make something that is so strong and emotional in parts of it using puppets made out of recycled things that I had no idea how to make in the first place.
You see the story of Pinocchio.
It's a little bit like that, yes. And that, you know, that I somehow managed to bring these things to life. And just as with my story about Der Golem, it's that the life only happens when there's truth in it. And so these characters come to life, you believe them, because there's a bit of truth in them.
What do you think will happen now? Are there more places where you can send it?
Actually, there's the life of something on the festival circuit, on the film festival circuit, is around 2 years, and I'm just hitting the 1 year mark for my first acceptance in the festival. Oh, I should I've lived here long enough to not want to be a noter. I don't want to be the sort who just goes on and on about my awards. But let me tell you what it is that I've won. Because not just, you know, oh, aren't I so good? But here's what I've won. I've won best animation for the Los Angeles Independent Film Festival, best animation and best score in the Indie Horror Film Festival, the Los Angeles Horror Competition, summer 2017. I won Best Animation as well. Best
with
Music.
With a cheap camera.
Huh? With a cheap camera. And it's grainy.
It adds to the horror.
It's noisy. It's definitely very, very low fidelity, the whole thing. And it does help add to the horror of it. And it adds to the, it almost looks like you're seeing something real shot with a cheap camera because it's all shot on, you know, a old, at this point, it's a 15-year-old Nikon Coolpix. So we're not talking about the high-end cinematographer. Yeah. And so a lot of it was lit with candlelight because I found that the flickering candlelight would bring even a completely still set of images to life because you can't fake that. And so in the course of the whole thing, I learned a lot about lighting and using, you know, using single source lighting and using fill lighting and all those things that people who are real filmmakers, I don't mean to belittle myself, but people who've actually studied this and gone to film school, they know this stuff inside and out. And I was just kind of figuring it out as I go and trying not to set the house on fire while I did it. So far, knock wood, I have not yet set off the fire alarms. I'm very proud of that.
So are you submitting it to more places?
Yeah. Because all the submission fees are in American dollars, I
didn't realize you had to pay for it.
Oh, yes. The film festival circuit is messy. And I probably should address that.
And because, are there a lot of people who send in their stuff?
Oh, thousands. Messes? There are thousands of people who send in their films, and the smaller film festivals are completely disorganized and kind of a mess to deal with because you have one or two people doing the same amount of work that a 100-person staff would do for the large film festivals. And it's just people who love film putting together a film festival, and they get volunteers and they make things work and they put it together. But it's a lot less organized, a lot less clean and slick than going to Cannes or Sundance or South by Southwest. Getting a movie this small and with no promotional budget behind it, no funding, nothing, and no advertising into the larger festivals is nearly impossible, because what they're looking for is the people who have big backing.
But if you get into Cannes, doesn't that...
Well, that certainly raises my profile a little bit, and it doesn't just stoke my ego, though it did a little bit.
Hand on the heart.
And hand on heart, look, I honestly, it did make me feel really, really good. I'm not going to lie. But at the same time, I know that the chances of that happening are very slim. And so this will help me get into other festivals, but bearing in mind that it's really... I'm up against a particular prejudice, and it's probably justified prejudice, but the prejudice is animated films are supposed to be for children, and I've made something that is a little bit frightening.
Well, I should think that parents would buy it for Halloween.
I should think so. And
has anybody interviewed you from New Zealand?
No, this is my first New Zealand interview.
Ah.
Most people hear my accent and switch off. I get it. In fact, there have been a few kind of somewhat famous people who've been talking about film lately, who really went hammer and tongs at someone because they were born in India. And so, you know, the fact that I have an accent and that I wasn't born here, that's made it harder for me to get places, because I am not your typical New Zealand filmmaker.
Are you a typical American filmmaker?
No, I'm not.
Are you a typical anything?
I'm not a typical anything. I have the blessing and curse. I think of it as a blessing, but the blessing and curse of being pretty unique without ever having to try.
So where to now? Are you going to write some more music?
Yes.
Are you?
My next project, I have a librettist in Los Angeles who wants me to write music for a musical about New Orleans. And that's probably the next thing I'm going to start turning up the works on. Also, as I mentioned last week, I recently released a techno album of dance music, which
What's
is
a techno album.
Oh, it's that modern dance music that you hear
Where everybody jumps up and down.
That's the one.
Like a Maasai.
Yeah.
It's the same as the Maasai warriors.
Exactly.
Picking up their hand and jumping.
Yes,
up
yes,
and, down.
And it's made for that, and so I'm doing animated music videos for that. That's all hand drawn instead of hand built, and
so you draw as well.
I draw as well. I actually used to be the illustrator for the front cover of the Jewish Journal in Los Angeles, and so I would do lots of I'm using a computer to draw, but drawing by hand using a mouse. So because I liked that hand drawn human
image.
Touch.
Yeah.
I think that you know, all of my art that I make has to have the human touch, or anybody could have done it. And whereas if there are wiggly lines, or if the timing on the performance isn't exactly on the beat, it gives it more of my personality. And that's exactly what my whole philosophy of art is. It has to have some of your spirit in it, and you do that by just getting your hands on your medium and doing something.
Well, I see your project as being on a boat, putting your thing in the boat and sending it out, and goodness knows where it'll land.
Indeed.
So I wish you every good fortune, and we'll keep in touch as to what your next project will be, because I think we need some more music programs.
I think so.
With history of some of the artists at which you excel at. And so thank you, Carvin. I'm really grateful to you, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10 past 10. And if you've missed this program, you can go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom. And we would like to thank our sponsor, Nature Bee.